Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Just to let you know that this next item covers material of a serious nature, but it also gives us an insight into how traumatic the criminal law process can be for many victims of sexual abuse. What does it take to tell the Gardaí about an historic sexual abuse? And how do you face going into court and confronting your abuser? Well, my next guest is William Edgell, who was just 12 years old when he was sexually abused over a four-year period. Last May, Elam Wolfe, formerly known as Derek Davis, was jailed for 2.5 years after he was found guilty of 20 counts of indecent assault and 18 counts of gross indecency between 1976 and 1980. William, you're very, very welcome to the programme.
Thank you, Deirdre.
Your case was heard in camera or private, but in an act of extraordinary courage, which is allowing us to speak today, you waived your right to anonymity. I know that it's obviously still probably very, very difficult for you to talk about, but can you maybe share with us some of the lifelong impacts that you've experienced as a result of the sexual abuse you suffered?
It's an interesting question, and I guess something that I'm now better able to attribute things that have happened to me that maybe I just, for example, I left school early. I thought I was thick, not capable of learning. And that's impacted every aspect of my, from career to day-to-day living. I'm not good with male friends. I don't trust men easily. I don't find it comfortably to be in groups. And considering my background is in hotel management, It's sort of a priority of the job that, A, I like, can get on with men, and B, I can cope in spaces, but I'm uncomfortable in places I don't know.
Is that all men? Like family members or...?
Yeah, I'm just keep them at a distance. It's a terrible... I'm really untrusting of men. My experience is you get hurt.
How has that impacted your ability to form or sustain relationships, whether it's sexually intimate or just intimacy with friends, or
it's made it incredibly difficult. I have a small number of friends, but they're friends. They are there, but I haven't been able to go to their weddings, their christenings, their parties, because I feel just uncomfortable in groups of people I don't know. I like to know my surroundings, who I'm with, where I'm with, and I'm safe. If that makes sense.
It does. It's the safety that you didn't have as a young child. After the abuse that you experienced, and you say it affected every single aspect of your being, from your education, your confidence, everything, but you've went into a form of exile for almost 40 years. Where did you go, and what was happening to you during, I suppose, the one of the most significant periods of your life?
I suppose I went to England first, where a way of dealing with the pain was to work as long and as hard as possible, because that kept me busy. That meant I wasn't, like, I'm not good in crowds, not good on my own either. So it kept me around people at a safe distance. So I worked really hard that, and then I went to Australia and spent a number of years in Australia. And again, it was working hard, wonderful environment, made great people, but I was away from home. And
you come from Tullamore, where everyone knows each other.
Where everybody knows everybody, yeah.
So you take yourself off, you build a life. It's a functional life in maybe many respects, but that going away, whether it was to the UK or literally to the other side of the world, to Australia, was that, do you think, you running away or trying to get away as far as possible from your abuser who was in your community and who was a family friend?
Yeah, I don't like to think I've run away from anything in my life, but possibly. By being out of the country, I was guaranteed I wasn't going to meet him or his family. And there's a big comfort in that knowing you can walk down the street, I'm not going to bump into him.
You finally did tell someone. Who was that person, and what was it that made you take that first step to admit to someone other than yourself?
I'd come home from London due to COVID. Much safer living in Ireland, full stop, but with COVID, it was definitely much safer. And then Ireland became my home again, and I had reintegrated into family and community. I needed to start afresh, to not be afraid, to be able to go to Tullamore and not wonder who I'm going to meet on the street.
And even after all of that,
And also, one of my godsons is approaching the age that my sexual abuse started, and that makes me sick, and terrifies me. I know he's safe, but how safe is safe? And it's really, as you can probably hear my voice, it bothers me now. So I couldn't live and hide anymore. There had to be a time when I had to do something about it. So I went one afternoon, I think, to the Garda station in Tullamore and went in and waited my turn and knocked on the window.
The wee window.
Pressed the buzzer. And this very young guard, given my age, everybody's young. This young guard came out, told him briefly, and he very quickly guessed the seriousness of the situation, and he moved me from a public area to a private room where he took basic information with great delicacy and kindness and compassion and understanding for me, and then told me what the
and
next...
he was the first person you
He was the first person I had told. I have never spoken about this to anybody in, 48 years or something?
That was a very important first encounter to receive that compassion and that understanding from that young guard.
Yeah, I was totally thrown off balance. I wasn't expecting, I was hoping possibly, but I hadn't given it any great thought. But it meant so much to be listened to and to be heard and for somebody to understand the trauma and pain that I personally have experienced.
What's really extraordinary is, you know, that, and for many people listening, you know, the mantra when we were growing up was that children should be seen and not heard. It took so long for you to break that silence.
Yeah.
What's interesting is that this story is not over in a sense, William, because the abuser is appealing the conviction. But the jury believed you unanimously, and the trial judge, and I will get to some of his remarks later on, but he said the conviction was an absolute and complete vindication of you. But we lose so many cases from that, maybe that first courageous step of reporting, to carry it right the whole way through to conviction. Your first experience with the guards was very positive. Did that continue in terms of dealing with the state, whether it was through the director of the public prosecutions? Because at the end of the day, you're just a witness.
Yeah, it's interesting. I very quickly learned that the court case, it's all about me, but nothing to do with me. Yeah. I am just a name. So my dealings with the state, the guards were magnificent and got better on every occasion. They worked diligently, passionately and cared.
Because there are many challenges with the historic case.
Huge challenges, you know. And actually, I never thought it would get to court. I never thought there would be a verdict of guilty reached. And for me, for the guards to say, William, we wholeheartedly believe you, that was amazing. You know, for somebody to say, we hear you, William, we believe you.
At what point did you bring your family into the fact that you were going through this process and that you were going to see it through?
I think I told them the next day after I had spoken to the guards, that very next day. I went and saw my immediate family and some friends, but very small, 6 people or less.
That must have come as a huge shock to them.
Oh, yeah. They were absolutely sorry they didn't know, sorry they weren't there for me, sorry that hurt deeply that it was the person that abused me was a friend of my family's who was close and they cared about. So that hurt hugely. And also, I think that just didn't, that I, they felt sorry that I couldn't feel, tell anybody, you know, that, you know, we're a close family, but that, and I've shared everything too much sometimes, but this was one thing I didn't share.
But of course, that is the experience of many people who have experienced abuse, that, and the judge, the trial judge spoke about that, the shame and the stigma and the silence that is so pervasive, because for a long part of your life, they perhaps maybe didn't know why it was that you were working away.
Yeah, absolutely. No understanding why I would choose to work rather than go to a family gathering, or why I was away.
This was obviously a unique process for you, and going into court. Did you get preparation? Like, I mean, how well can they prepare you for walking into, you know, the criminal courts of justice, or just even seeing the layout of a courtroom or any of like that, and what the process itself would be like?
They can't prepare you well enough at all. You have no idea. It's nothing like TV. Fortunately, I was brought, the guards arranged for me to see the court and to meet the state barrister and state solicitor. About 15 minutes or so, I was brought into the courtroom. It's huge. It's very, it's empty in a way. It's quiet. The furniture is big and heavy. You're very alone. And that's it. You go, this is sort of what's going to happen. You'll sit there but you have no idea when it comes to jury selection, and there's 200 plus people in the court, and there's three other cases, and juries have been picked for everybody. And it's the first time you hear and see your abuser. And
did you hear him or see him first?
I saw him first. I didn't recognise him, and I wouldn't have known it was him, only I'd been told that's where he'd sit. I knew his voice as soon as I'd heard it. And it's quite chilling to hear 38 times somebody say not guilty. I didn't do it. You know, that's very tough.
Even though you know it's a plea because it's going to trial, was that just very difficult to,
yeah, I found
to
that
hear that denial?
Really, really hard. And I was very fortunate. I had two buddies, I guess, from court services. I'm not sure.
Liaison. Is that their liaison. The court liaison, the people who try and guide you.
Who can guide you without telling you.
Of course.
So they were truly gifted in their role. And that's what you asked me earlier, but that was my experience. Everybody was there to help me. Couldn't tell me what was going to happen because they didn't want me to know how I was going to react to a question. So, you know, you trusted in them. And my trust wasn't misplaced.
No, because there's such a complete vulnerability. And you mentioned this earlier, as a witness, as the complainant, you're at the centre of things, but in another sense you're not, because it's an adversarial system. Because you were a complainant, you were required to take the stand and not only to be examined by the prosecution, but also to be subject to cross-examination by the defence. And what supports did you have? Like, I mean, did you marshal any family members or anyone to come to you? Did you want them to see you go through that process?
Actually, I was pretty determined. I didn't want anybody to come to court because I very quickly understood that the conversation is horrendous. You have to vividly describe every act that happened to you. There's no brushing it under the counter. That's not nice. Not nice for me, who it happened to listen to. It's certainly not nice for anybody else. And I didn't want to put my loved ones through that. The guards were quite, I won't say forceful, but they encouraged me strongly to have somebody there. So I had my uncle and some friends came. Only one came into the court with me because the rest, Tullamore, were very fortunate. It has a facility for victims, families and friends to be. Not all courts do.
Absolutely.
So big issue. So my uncle came to and sat in the court when I was on the witness stand.
And as you say, so difficult, not only for you to articulate it, but for others to hear it. We have an adversarial legal system, a criminal law system with a very high standard of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And, you know, and each team has a role, the prosecution to bring forward a presentable case for the defence. They have to protect the constitutional presumption of innocence that all of us have, including your abuser. And that obviously involves a very robust testing of the evidence. But were you prepared for that level of rigour and some of the propositions that were put to you in your role as the complainant?
Looking back at it, I'd say no. I was told that things had changed. That was not my experience, sadly.
The judge acknowledged that it was a very distressing, you know, experience for you, that, you know, and in terms of the propositions that were put to you, one of them, which the judge even remarked on, was incredible. That was that it was suggested to you or put to you by the defence that you may have even enjoyed the abuse, even though you were only 12 years of age. And the judge did say, actually, in the ruling, that this was kind of incredible or remarkable in circumstances where the accused was obviously denying that any abuse took place. What is it like when your character, your history, all of those aspects, and including some of those propositions, are put to you? What does it feel like?
I think at the moment when they've been put to you, you don't have time to take it all in. There's so much happening. But certainly to be told at 12 that I was getting enjoyment from it, I was shocked.
And obviously, and the judge did remark that you had really been distressed by the experience. The defence barrister, in the course of the cross-examination, unintentionally revealed a specific health condition that you have and that you had asked to be kept confidential. And the judge said it was a very understandable, reasonable and achievable request that that health condition not be disclosed. That's not what happened.
No, I had made myself fully available, my medical records and every aspect of my life was made available to the guards, who questioned everything, and to, I'm going to say my abuser, I hate that word, so
not my abuser.
Their side got all of the information. And I had, with one proviso, I had asked for one specific set of diagnosis or information to be withheld. And it was redacted, and both sides agreed before the case started that this would be that this wouldn't be mentioned. It had no clear great bearing anyway. In fact, none of it had. I was 12 at the time. This is, you know, they're looking at medical history that's after the date of 12. So a little hard to figure, but no, it got brought up.
So you felt hugely insulted, and the judge did make very strong and stringent remarks on it. You know, he obviously, the counsel apologised at the time, but for you it was too little too late. The damage was done for you. And the judge did say that I accept that the defence counsel is very capable and fair-minded counsel. There was no deliberate intention on his part to embarrass the victim. It seemed clear that his judgment was clouded by his desire to represent and protect his client's interests. That being said, though, William, It was hugely damaging for you. But it does bring up this question, you know, that the disclosure of medical records, sensitive information, the disclosing of counselling records are part and parcel of the criminal law process. And, you know, and again, you know, the judge, I think he was remarking about how this can be highly stressful. It can actually lead to what he described as the re-traumatisation of victims. Did you feel that you were reliving your own trauma in that moment?
I think I've relived it on several occasions, from making my initial statement to repeating it again to guards, to certainly what 5 hours in the witness stand. And it was worse because you think of the law as a balanced and decent people.
And I know, obviously, the judge did address it and he said it wasn't deliberate, but he said, nevertheless, he was emphatic about it, that it should not have happened. And we should say, absolutely, you know, unanimous, the jury count. And he said they emphatically believed you. But at the end of the ruling, he thanked you personally for your eloquence, your resilience and your bravery, not only to make the complaint, but to see it through. And he said that by doing so, you'd vindicated not only yourself, but it also provided an example and a pathway to other victims who themselves are seeking justice. Did you ever doubt that you wouldn't follow the process through?
There's an interesting question. No, I never. I never questioned that I wouldn't go through. I'm not a quitter, and I can understand, after my experience, of people quit. But I have good friends. I trusted in the guards, in the state barrister and the state solicitor, and my fate kept me sane.
So many abusers, like the person who was convicted after your trial, they evade scrutiny and they evade accountability because of that silence you spoke about, the stigma, the shame. To anyone listening who perhaps is considering making a complaint or are going through the process, what would you say to them? Was it worth it for you?
Oh, absolutely. It's worth it. I'm a new person. I have lifted a weight off my shoulders that I didn't know was there. You know, the number of people who have spoken to me, very few people know about what I've been through or my court case, but the number of people who have told me they've been abused that have never told any before, it's nearly 30 people. That's 30 people who have never spoken to anybody. Why did you choose to speak to me? I'm not sure. So yes, I would recommend they think about it, they get some proper advice, speak to the Rape Crisis Centre, who are excellent. And in my experience, the guards are amazing.
And can I just, you know, one of the things that Judge Johnson also said, it's worth reading in full because he addresses so many issues, not just your case, but also the process and as well the impacts. But he said that he doesn't think the negative impacts of sexual abuse and how it adversely impacts victims is readily understood by society at large. And I'm just wondering, you could have chosen anonymity, but how do you think we can change that? And particularly when you said just at the outset of our conversation, when you look at your young godson and you're thinking, well, you know, that perhaps that child you once were, how do we empower people, young and not so young, to talk about this issue?
I guess you asked me about waiving my right to anonymity. I have a voice, and again, my faith tells me about justice, so I felt I have experience. I know what's happened, so I need to talk about it. And the only way we can deal with sexual abuse or violence is to talk about it. It's not something to be put under the floor or to be whispered about. We can't deal with anything until we can have a grown-up and adult conversation about things that are going on in our families. Never mind, we talk about our institutions, our schools, our fate, our other bodies.
And of course, the vast majority
is the person we know next door or in our own family. You know, so it's vital that we talk and people are educated and not afraid.
Can I ask you about your own family and the support you've received? Your lovely mum passed away before she could see the conviction and the sentence, and it must have been difficult bringing her into that confidence. But
My mum was an amazing woman who has guided and cared and loved me continuously throughout my life. So it was heartbreaking to tell her, and I am devastated she didn't get to hear the judgment. She supported me and wanted me to get justice. But I believe she's with me, so she's never far away. So I know she knows I got justice. And I have some hope that she had an involvement in it. You know, whatever that is, I believe it.
And you're smiling as you say that. Can I ask you just one last question? Normally when victims waive the right to anonymity and do so courageously, have you done, it's for the most part, it's women that are doing that. We very, very rarely hear or perhaps don't hear enough from male victims of sexual violence. Is it other men who've approached you about their experiences?
Yeah, it's. I suppose I've known for the last 40 odd years about my abuse and never been able to speak about it. But often you hear of sexual abuse and it's always women, and you sort of scream at the TV and go, for God's sake, there's men, there's boys, there's children. So out of the 30 people that have told me, informed me, some of whom I know quite well and some of whom I really don't know, it's been a mixture of men and boys, 18-year-olds, and women of every age. These are people who have never told anybody. I'm the first person that they have trusted to listen to. Not much I can do, only listen. But I know from my experience what it's like, so I hope that helps. But, you know, I don't think I've done anything tremendous or wonderful or brave. I've just been the voice of truth in my experience.
I don't think you realise how important that voice and using it has been. William Edgell, thank you so, so much. And just to say to anyone listening, if you've been impacted by any of the issues that William has raised in this interview, you'll find help at rte.ie/helplines. William Edgell, thank you so much again.
Thank you, Deborah.
Email brendan@rte.ie.